Daniel, thanks for reading. We're on page 23 in the handouts and 1 Corinthians 15 for our last talk. On the first night, we quoted from Richard Dawkins on the resurrection, and we quoted him and we agreed with him. The resurrection, if it really happened, was a concrete, scientific kind of event. But Richard Dawkins, of course, does not believe in the resurrection. And I think I can lift from this book his comment on TAST 2016. And if you asked him for an endorsement for TAST 2016, here's what I think he would say. He would say that to believe in a God is, and now I'm quoting, is to squander your precious time on worshipping, sacrificing, fighting, and dying. What do you think? After three talks on the resurrection from 1 Corinthians 15, has it basically been a call to squander your life? Squander your precious time on worshipping and sacrificing. In fact, let's be clearer. Do you realise that for three talks, I have been the mad mullah that the Daily Mail is so frightened of? My favourite political cartoon ever, I think, came in Private Eye just after the July the 7th bombings. It was two people. It was a young boy and a Muslim imam. And the imam was in his 40s or 50s. The boy was 13 or 14. And the cleric was strapping a bomb vest onto the young boy. And he was saying, "Go on, my son. Go and be brave." That's just a brilliant cartoon. Gets to the, you know, the hypocrisy. "You go and be brave for me over there. I'd never do it." Is that what you think I've done this week? The evil old cleric and a room full of impressionable young students. The mad mullah says, "Destroy yourself," says, "It's worth it. You go straight to Allah and there are 70 virgins waiting for you." Can you tell the difference between what we've done and that? Richard Dawkins can't. Can't tell the difference. I'm not sure that David Cameron's British Values can tell the difference either, really. I've got a newspaper article here as well from earlier this year, or earlier last year now. This is Ayaan Hirsi Ali. She's a Somalian. She was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood and is now an activist against extremism. She's speaking at David Cameron and saying there's no point trying to meet with the moderate preachers in order to combat extremism. As long as preachers teach that life after death is more important than life before death, they are part of the problem, she says. Her suggestion for Islam is that you remove all the teachings that suggest the primacy of the hereafter, she says, over the here and now. In fact, she thinks the UK government should get Muslim preachers to swear allegiance, pledge allegiance to that, that the here and now is more important than the hereafter. And if they don't swear allegiance to that, then you kick them out of the country. And without that, there is nothing really to distinguish the so-called moderates from the radicals. The moderates may have nicer haircuts, they may have calmer voices, but it is the same radical teaching. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 is utterly radical, isn't it? Utterly life-changing. Says you can waste, spend, squander, even destroy this life because you have a second, better body to come. That is radical teaching, not moderate teaching, isn't it? I certainly wouldn't want you to make decisions here this week while you're kind of bleary-eyed with tiredness because you stayed up all last night playing Avalon or whatever it is. I wouldn't want to do anything like that to you secretly. Big decision made without serious thought. This chapter is a radical chapter. We said last night the big difference to radical Islam is that David Cameron has nothing whatsoever to fear from us. You know, if Paul persuades you to live the way he wants you to, then all you're going to do is go around loving people and giving up your time to help them and giving your money away to help the poor and speaking words. You know, that's your big weapon, speaking words about Jesus. David Cameron has nothing to fear, if only he understood that. the people with something to fear from 1 Corinthians 15 are you and me, are the people sitting here in this room. Because Paul is asking us to give up, to squander our precious time now in exchange for the work of the Lord, because the life after death is more important. That's radical, isn't it? But radical used not to be a dirty word. In fact, the generation now making laws in Parliament, they were all radicals when they were at school and at student time. They were radical communists, or they were radical free marketists, whatever that is. They were radical feminists. They were radical pacifists. Remember Richard Cunningham from UCCF saying, over his 20, 30 years in student work, the biggest change he's seen on campuses is that now the only radicals left on campus are the Christians, and everybody else is boringly moderate. An earlier generation loved being radical because it meant you actually cared about something. You actually had a purpose that you thought was worth some effort, worth bothering with. Students today, even students at SOAS, care more about paying off the student loan, care more about saving up for a mortgage than they do about saving the world. It's a strange thing, isn't it? I think I'm beginning to think that the student loan is actually, you know, the most brilliant means of social control that has ever been invented, as a means of encouraging conformity to what everybody else lives for. It's brilliant. You know, please spend your life paying down the debt, working up the career ladder, paying your taxes, and buying bigger TVs. Claire and I, we finally, since we got married, we bought the plunge and bought a bigger TV last week. We blew the dust off some vouchers we had, went into John Lewis, bought a bigger TV. I think in David Cameron's mind, that is the most socially useful thing we've done in 15 years. And that kind of gets us to 1 Corinthians 15's answer to Dawkins, Ali, and Cameron. I think it's the Bible's answer to Dawkins, Ali, and Cameron. The answer is that our culture is not being straightforward with you about your choices. I mean to be straightforward with you about your choices, but I don't think our culture is. The setup is, isn't it, that you've got normality over here, and normality is to live for now, and that is precious and beautiful and noble and moderate and sensible and balanced, and your family will be happy and your society will be happy. Versus you got radical over there. Radical is to live for the future, and that is unhinged and radical and extreme and difficult. And when really, that is not the decision at all. Really, the question is, what are you going to live your life for? That's the question every human being should face. What is it you're going to be all about? What are you going to live for? And I think what we've done this week, we've done three talks of kind of Paul reassuring you that a life lived for Jesus is not wasted, is not in vain. But now in the last talk, here is something a little bit more aggressive from Paul, I think. I think it's been there in the whole chapter, but he lands it here in the last nine verses. And Paul wants to say, the Bible wants to say, that the vain, wasted, squandered life, that is the one that Dawkins, Ali, and Cameron are selling you. And the choice isn't between kind of normal and radical. The choice is, do you want to work for Jesus, or do you want to work for yourself? As in, against Jesus. Do you want to work for now, for this life, for temporary things? Or do you want to work for then, for the next life, for what lasts forever? See, actually, there are only two kinds of radical. It's everyone's radical, really. You're either radically temporary or radically eternal. You're either radically selfish or radically Jesus-centered. Everybody has a root value. That's all radical means, your root value that you live by. And the Bible critique of now, sorry, that was this side, wasn't it? Bible critique of now and self, since Genesis 3, has been that that is all actually pathetic, temporary, empty, and vain. You can have a lot of fun along the way. living that way. The toys are fun, going on the holidays is fun. Claire and I are looking forward to being able to read the text that comes up in TV programs, not be able to read that for about a decade. They used to make it this big for people with tiny TVs. You know, it's nice to have a bigger TV, but really, it is small and passing and vain, and in the end, it counts for nothing. And I think the new year is a good time, isn't it, to look at that choice in cold blood. What is it that would count as a wasted 2016 for you? Well, how do you feel about 2015? Was 2015 a dynamic year of mighty progress? You know, did you tick off a load of big milestones achieved? Maybe some of you did, and you graduated BA from King's College London. You got engaged. You got your first girlfriend. You got offered a uni place. You got offered a job. You got offered an internship. Big ticks in the boxes. Or more likely speaking, biblically, maybe you think 2015 was a lot of hard work for nothing very much. The wheels were kept spinning. The assignments were handed in. The Christmas presents were paid for just about. The rent was paid maybe. But really, not so very much to show for 2015. And the older you get, the more obvious that gets. If you think about the Christmas newsletter, do your family send a Christmas newsletter? Embarrassing photos of you next to kind of whatever you did this year. Do you get them and read them from other families? And the problem with the Christmas newsletter is nobody is allowed to put the truth, which is that 2015 was basically a lot like 2014, really. And the kids are a little bit taller and a little bit smellier, and the older one has moved his smell to UCL, and that's nice. And the holiday was all right, but everything else just kind of went round the wheel. That's why I think so many people put their DIY in their Christmas newsletter. Do you spot that? So, you know, what has the Jones family got to show for 2015? Well, there is the new patio. You know, that's what we did. I mean, even if a builder did most of it, and even if it looks a lot like the old one, you can take a photo, it takes up half a page in the newsletter, we did that. But Genesis 3, where Nigel took us, well, tells us that the B&Q delivery lorry is always followed later by the skip lorry. Your new patio is going to go to landfill. 1 Corinthians 15 is all about resurrection, but I think we've heard it's also all about creation, isn't it? It's been about the creation of the world. It's been about Adam, where life comes from, and animals and birds and fish and sun and moon and stars. And it's also all about wasted effort, vanity, and worthlessness. Let me just show you that through the chapter so you believe me. Verse 2, unless you believed in vain. End of the verse. Or verse 10, by the grace of God I am what I am, and his grace towards me was not in vain. Or verse 14, twice, if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is in vain. Your faith is in vain. Or verse 17, similar words, your faith could be futile because not forgiven, and 18, perishing. Or verse 32, I'll sit the other way around. If you die every day, and it's just about life in this world, then what do you gain? What was the point? What was it worth? And then verse 58, of course, we kept coming back to. The whole chapter is about persuading you, offering you, actually, some labor, unlike every other kind of labor, that was not in vain. And London culture hates waste, doesn't it? Wasted seconds, particularly, our time. If you can save 30 seconds in a tube station, I never want to go that way again. If I spend 30 seconds waiting for a web page to download on my phone, I need a new phone. Okay, that's how serious we are about it. I'll spend any amount of money on labor-saving devices because my time is precious. I hate wasted seconds. But we are entirely comfortable with wasted lives. You take all the seconds we save, you glue them all together, 20 seconds here, 30 seconds here, you make a whole life, and we never ask if we wasted the whole thing, which is why our culture hates talking about death. Can't talk about death, because what if you had to admit that all of the normal things we do don't actually achieve anything very much. The big Bible overview picture we got open in 1 Corinthians 15 is you pick up the threads from Genesis 3, where the world is cursed. You maybe go through Ecclesiastes, where we were last year in the Bible overview, say the world is cursed, which means you still have a load of hard work, but most of it doesn't seem to make any difference. It is in vain. You do exams and coursework and jobs and promotions and you work and you get paid and you feed your body and you die. And nothing is different and nobody remembers you. I've spoken to a lot of people this week about their exams and their coursework. I don't want to be too miserable, but at home I've got some certificates, some of my exam certificates. My GCSE certificates, when do you think anyone last asked to see those certificates? Never. That's the answer. When were they last important? When was it last important what grade I got in my GCSEs? In the early 90s. It's the last time that mattered. And you already know the same is true of your A-levels. And you probably have a sneaking suspicion that the same is going to be true of your degree. Someone actually this year did ask me where I studied. And that was the first time that had mattered in over a decade. And the only reason they wanted to know it so they can put it on some conference publicity to give people the wrong reason to come and hear a talk I'm going to give. It really doesn't matter. Your dissertations, do you know, I wrote a dissertation once at Bible College. It still exists, I think. It's in a library in North London. And it is not worth the paper it was written on, printed on. As far as I know, only one person has ever skim-read it. And I wish they hadn't. If I'm honest. There was some stats out last month. 95% of arts research, 95% of social science research papers are never referenced in any other academic publication anywhere in the world. And I think that means no one's ever read them. Because if I read a paper, you know, as a history student, I was lazy. If I read a paper, it's going to go in a footnote. Okay? You're going to know. On a bigger life scale, who is going to remember you when you are dead? If you go with the David Cameron, Richard Dawkins life, what is it for? I think it was student supper. We did this exercise. Here's how it goes. If you were there, you remember. I hope you haven't done too much research since. But put up your hand if you know the name of a great-grandparent. Do you know the name, the first name of one of your great-grandparents? I do. Put up your name, know the first name of a great-grandparent. Let's have a few of those names. What's your great-grandparent's name?
Patrick Samuel.
That's lovely. Who have we got by there? Lindsay? Oh, sorry. Yeah, no, yeah.
Bert.
That's a great great-granddad name. What have we got? Who've got Nathan?
Tide.
It's just a weird name. Don't know even what that means. Alice. There we go. It's helpful, isn't it? So that's... The reason that's helpful is that's what hipsters now call their children, so make a list of kind of great-granddad names. Okay, hands up again if you knew the name of at least one great-grandparent. Okay, here's the thing. You had 8 great-grandparents. Keep your hand up. That's just simple biology, 2 parents, 4 grandparents, 8 great-grandparents. Keep your hand up if you know the name of all 8. Okay, in Greece, they care. Okay, that's interesting. All the rest of us, hands down. And yet those people, they did the right thing, didn't they? They did the thing that means you get to be immortal. They had kids who had kids who had kids, who are you. And they lived so recently. So your great-grandparents, they were giving birth to your grandparents probably in World War II. Okay? And they were probably being born themselves in World War I, which means that they were dying probably in the 1980s. Which to me feels like quite recently. Okay, quite recently, these people who were successful, who had kids, who had kids, who had kids, were dying in the 1980s, and no one can even remember their names. And if you can't remember their names, Magda excluded, then who is going to bother? And who is going to remember your name as time passes? So verse 58, I know we've had a kind of long wind-up, you're wondering where the passage is coming from. Verse 58 is much, much more than helping Christians feel better about missing out on getting drunk on a Friday night at uni. Verse 58 is the answer to the big human problem since Genesis chapter 3. What is life for? Is there any labour and work under the sun that isn't futile, empty and vain? And Paul ends in his last nine verses by giving us something to live for. So there's some headings on the sheets, and the first one, very quickly, is all change. All change, verse 50 to 53. And I think this is here because of one final objection in Corinth. It's not a great objection, but I think it was a real problem in Corinth. Their objection is, you know, what if Jesus comes back? All the dead bodies are okay. They come back out of the grave, get a new body. But what about us? What about the people left alive when Jesus comes back? And the answer, verse 51, is even though not everybody will sleep, it's not about task, that is about 1 Corinthian language for death, even though not everyone is going to be dead, we will all be changed. And every verse from 50 to 54, you've got two different groups being talked about, the alive Christians and the dead Christians in their graves. So like 52, there's going to be this big loud trumpet, and then the dead will be raised, imperishable. The runny, rotten corpses are going to become imperishable, and then we will be changed. Or 53, the corpses must put on imperishable, and this potentially dead body, this mortal body, this dying body that you have now, will put on immortality. So the last trumpet, verse 52, is like the loudest alarm clock ever. You may feel your neighbour, now is the time, give them a bit of that alarm clock treatment if they need it. And immortality is like getting properly dressed as a human being for the first time ever with a body that cannot die. And just notice what he said in their culture, okay, about immortality. Corinth is not that far from Mount Olympus, which is where the immortals live. You know, Zeus and Hephaestus and Poseidon and all that crew. And that is what the Christian gospel does. If Jesus was to come back this instant, that is what would happen to you. You would be changed into an immortal body. That's what you'd have. I always think it must be exciting to be a doctor, particularly every time you go to the theatre, every time you go on an aeroplane. Sam, is that true? Those exciting times, because you must be there waiting for that moment when somebody stands up and says, is there a doctor in the house? You know, because somebody's keeled over. That's exciting. And I was on a plane recently, and I was sat there thinking, you know, I wonder if that'll happen. I wonder if some doctor will have to do. I think I read about one that was open heart surgery with a coat hanger. I just think sounds fantastic. That's all he had on the plane, or she had on the plane. Fantastic. I remember thinking, though, while I was sat there, I wonder if anybody else on this plane, other than me, knows how to raise the dead. I wonder how many Christians there are on the plane. I wonder how many people there are with the verse 3, verse 4, gospel of Jesus Christ that saves, that makes people immortal. Yeah, I might actually be the only one on this plane that knows how to make someone immortal. So maybe when the doctor starts, when they do the announcement, bing bong, is there a doctor on the plane? You know, maybe I stand up too. So do you mind if I come as well? Because so before you try the tracheotomy with the biro, do you mind if I just tell the person about Jesus? Just in case, you know, they die while we're somewhere over the Indian Ocean. Because that is going to matter a whole lot more than your biro. Because if you're lucky, you can make them breathe all the way until we land near a hospital. But I have a gospel that can make them immortal. The Genesis 3 problem of humanity is completely overcome by the Christian gospel. We're not just talking about spiritual survival, we're talking about new immortal physical bodies. In our review group this morning, again, we were talking about why that makes a difference in temptation in particular. I want to just have one more go at why physical body in the future makes so much difference. Here's the thing. I think we don't admit it, but we all care so much about our bodies. I think stereotypically that was always true of women, but that maybe always was just a sexist assumption. But it is certainly clear now that men care about their bodies just as much. Claire and I were watching one of those kind of TV from the 80s compilation programs, and it brought up the 80s response to Miss World sexism. And the response was this kind of jokey Mr. Universe thing on British TV. First time that had been done on British TV. Kind of stage full of 80s men in their Speedos kind of came out. And the striking thing was that everybody I know, every man I know, is more buff than those men on TV in the 80s in the Mr. Universe thing. And, you know, men whose passionate hobby is computer engineering have now more muscle definition than international rugby players from the 1980s. And that's a kind of interesting social fact, isn't it? We care about bodies. And when there is a temptation, any temptation is a choice, isn't it? So do I want this or that? And if the choice is do something that my body wants that will make my body feel good, or choose something that is spiritual and floaty in the future, I think certainly for men, that just feels like one more thing about Christianity that isn't very real, isn't very male even. You know, talking and feeling your soul sitting knitting on a cloud somewhere. That's for girls, kind of roughly, isn't it? Though actually, I suspect for women too, the choice body now or spirit soul in the future is, you know, that doesn't actually help very much. But Paul is giving us, we will all change. We'll all put on immortality, physical bodies. So the choice is what my body wants now or what my better immortal body will have in the future. I think that's why this helps. Okay, that's why that helps, but it's still very personal, isn't it? Still very small scale. It's still about me. So let's go from all change, point one, to what that means. What that means is death defeated, which is to say your life doesn't need to be about paying off the student loan and the mortgage. It doesn't even need to be about my personal project of kind of steering my way through life and through the temptations of life so that I get safely home to heaven. Your life can be about God's big project of making a new heaven and a new earth. God created the world, heaven and earth at the beginning. He is planning to recreate a new heaven and a new earth at the end. And your labor, your work, your bothering with being a Christian can be part of that project. And that is the only defeat of vanity and emptiness. So similar to what he said in verse 24 to 28, our resurrection, our transformation, that is what defeats death. Pick it up in verse 54. When the perishable puts on imperishable corpses and the mortal puts on immortality, us if we're still alive, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, then death is swallowed up in victory. If God wants to defeat death, then the resurrection of Christians is absolutely necessary. And the work and the labor of getting other people to hear the gospel and stand in it, that is the work and labor of the new creation. The work and labor that conquers death, puts to an end the human problem since Genesis 3. Just like verse 10, go back to verse 10. What was God being kind to Paul? It says in verse 10 that by the grace of God I am what I am. What was grace to an enemy of God? I think it's very surprising. The grace was not in vain because, on the contrary, was it that he was kind of personally saved, allowed to go to heaven? No, that's not what it says. It doesn't even say it was because, you know, he was able to be very fruitful, the results of his ministry. What was grace, what was kindness to Paul was, I worked harder than any of them. Hard work, labor, that is not in vain. If it is labor for the overthrow of this creation and death in this creation, that is work that is not in vain. So verse 58, when it says work of the Lord, those words only come together three times in 1 Corinthians. And one of them is in verse 58. One of them is in 9 verse 1, where Paul says that he's an apostle and that the church in Corinth is his workmanship in the Lord. That's his DIY project. What did you do in 2015, Paul? Well, God, you kindly let me build a church in Corinth. Okay, now that one, all the other Christmas letters in the world go in the bin, and that one is part of God's new creation. Or the other one is 16 verse 10, where Paul's deputy, Timothy, is going to come with this letter. Okay, this letter is a letter to a problem church. Timothy is coming with his knees knocking. Okay, who knows how they're going to react to this. And what Timothy's going to come and do and speak to them, he is doing the work of the Lord among you, as Paul is. So all the stuff, the verses 1 to 11, don't you believe in vain, when Timothy tells them that, when he tells them, chapters 5 to 7, stop it with the self-pleasing sin. Chapters 8 to 10, will you give up your life, your freedoms for other people? Chapters 12 to 14, will you use your gifts to serve other people? That is Timothy encouraging them. That is the work of the Lord. And by implication, them encouraging each other, them making decisions to do those things, and that is effort and hard work that is not like any other effort and work in this world, because it's part of building the new creation that is formed of people with new resurrection bodies, just like Jesus when death is defeated. I've got on the sheet two of the Old Testament passages that Paul is referencing, two of the three, I think. Isaiah 25, don't turn to it, it's quoted in verse 54. I'm going to just read you a little bit of it. It's a very appropriate chapter to go to when we're talking about new physical bodies in a new creation. God's picture of a new world is very physical. He says, on this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all people a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, of rich food full of marrow. I think they liked eating marrow then. Of aged wine, well refined. You know, hungry? The board says it's roast dinner for lunch. You get to go and have roast dinner as soon as I stop speaking. You hungry? Rich foods, the best meat, the finest smell. Heaven is not floaty. It is an enormous pig-out feast. But in Isaiah, it's not just the people eating. It is God eating as well. God is going to swallow up on this mountain the covering cast over all peoples, the veil spread over all nations. What is it that is damping down everything human beings have ever been about? Verse 8, he will swallow up death forever. The Lord God will wipe away tears, and the reproach, the shame of his people, he will take away. Genesis 3 through to Revelation 21. And we are part of the defeat of death. Hosea 13 verse 14 is the other one for the notes. We're not going to read it. It's quoted in verse 55. Or if we're being honest, it's misquoted in verse 55, because in Hosea, it is God shouting for death. God is calling for death to come and kill sinful Israel. Remember again, Nigel's overview, as the people of Israel rebelled against God, God brought death for them. Come and bring your sting. Please come and destroy these sinful rebels, as the law says you should. But now Paul quotes it, says everything has changed. We're not calling for death now, because Jesus, by rising from the dead, he has disarmed death. So by telling people the gospel, by doing the labor of the Lord, we are defusing death for other people. We said we imagined death as like the big final boss in a computer game. With verse 56 open, let's imagine him as a big scorpion, okay? Because he's got a sting, and the sting is sin, and the power in the sting is the law. It says, this is bad, and you knew it. So there's the scorpion slashing out at people, killing them. But in Jesus, as he rises from the dead, bringing with him everybody who's united into him, it's like what Jesus done is kind of snapped off the end of the scorpion's tail and replaced it with a pom-pom, like he's a little poodle. Okay, so that now big angry death goes around, and when he meets a Christian, instead of whoosh and stings them, he goes thud, thud, thud. It's kind of sweet, really, as he kind of just thumps at them. I told you about my friend Ali, whose funeral was last term. Death is still sad, don't get me wrong. She died in her early 30s, leaving behind two little boys and a husband and ministry and friends. But death is completely powerless with Ali, really, because of someone at St. Helens, actually. There was a teacher called Susan. She taught Ali and Susan taught together at a school in London. Susan, not a super Christian, she's not in Christian work, she's not the super Christian workers are super Christian. You know, she was doing the labor of the Lord in her normal job. She took the cost, the consequence, the suffering of going up to this new young teacher and encouraging her to think about Jesus, talk about her. I guess that was frightening, as it would be for any of us. I guess that cost effort. But Susan Ho, bomb disposal specialist. That's how you should think about Susan Ho from the Sunday morning congregation. Because as she told Ali the gospel, she effectively removed sin and law from her. The big scorpion is now the big poodle, as far as Ali was concerned. So she has fallen asleep, and it is just falling asleep, because we have no worries about where she'll be. She'll rise. Third Old Testament passage, Isaiah 65, which is the new creation passage in Isaiah, and it is also one of the very few Old Testament passages that combines the idea of labor and work and the idea of in vain, and one of the very, very few that combines them positively. The big feature of the new creation, according to Isaiah 65, is that our labor will no longer be in vain. Unlike everything else from Genesis 3 to Revelation 20, because once we're there, futility will be gone, vanity will be gone. And even now, I think with 1 Corinthians 15 open, we can say the defeat of death is our work, is our new creation labor. And do you not want to give your life radically to it? And do you know why they put flags at half-mast when someone dies? Have you ever wondered why they do that? Have you ever wondered why it isn't really half-mast? You know, it's just kind of a little titchy bit down. Have you seen that when you know, someone in the royal family dies, you move the flag down a bit? It is from 18th century naval warfare. And what it is you move the flag down just far enough to put over the top the flag that has conquered. Okay, so in 18th century naval warfare, it's the English against the French, which is where I feel most comfortable. And you know, you capture the French ship, you run the French flag down just a bit, and you put a British flag over the top. That says Britain has won. We've got this ship. You move a flag down to half mast to say that death has won. The invisible flag of death is there on the flagpole. He's won another victory. Another person has died. And the best bits in the kind of silly novels about 18th century naval warfare is the bit when the smoke clears for a second and you see an English ship, British ship, drifting the wrong way with a French flag over the top, and the dynamic English naval captain says, you know, man the boats, off we go! And you charge through the smoke and you storm the ship and you push, you know, Johnny Foreigner in the sea, and then he took, sorry, a lot of people, I know, anyway, and then he turns to his man and he says, Brown, run the colours, run that flag down and run the colours back up. And the British flag goes back over the top. You know, I am a total pathetic man. I've never been anywhere near the army, wouldn't be allowed in. But doesn't your soul move at the idea of being involved in a campaign against death? You know, run down death's flag and stick Jesus' flag back up again. Doesn't that seem like something you might want to give your life for? I mentioned my friend who I was talking to in our sitting room about the gospel, and I came out of the room and realized if I kept pushing, and I was trying to push because of 1 Corinthians 15 and a talk I'd given on it, if I keep pushing, I might lose my oldest friend, the one, you know, the one we shared a tent on top of the glacier on the most miserable life of our lives together kind of friend. Went into the other room, am I going to keep pushing? Went back in, kept pushing. And Penn, he's got a stupid name, that's his name, Penn believed the gospel. Wasn't straightforward, but he came to Christianity Explored at St. Helens. He heard about the gospel, we read Colossians together. There's ups and downs since then. He finds it very hard with he's got a performing arts job, very hard for him to get to church on a Sunday. He kind of stopped for a bit, but then very recently we've been reading 1 Corinthians together. In fact, we start 1 Corinthians 15. We've got up to the end of 4. We start 15 this term. I'm really looking forward to it. With him, my friend Penn, death has lost him because I took a tiny risk to be a bit scared and to push him a bit and tell him the gospel. I think that is worth being scared. So let's do a bit of application until time is up and it's lunch. So point three, therefore verse 58. And just notice, a few people have said to me, you know, is this just for the lunatic Christians? You know, is this really a chapter for the kind of super keen Christians? I think most of us, what we do with a chapter like this is we go home thinking, I must be a bit more something. And what we do is we calibrate off all our non-Christian friends and go, as long as, you know, my TV is only 80% as big as their TV, or you know, my holiday is only 80% as expensive as their holiday, then brilliant, I've done a bit more, I'm a good Christian. I think for a lot of Christian kids growing up in materialistic Western culture, Christian parents are easily giving the impression that you can do both, can't you? Live for yourself, live for Jesus. Let's do both. Well, this chapter is a warning chapter. Verses 1 to 11 particularly, maybe verse 34. Warning, actually, you cannot straddle normal and radical, or you can't straddle self and Jesus. John chapter 12, when we get there in IGG and RML. Unless you follow me to the cross, Jesus says, you're not really my disciple. Same as Mark 8, Jesus or self, that's the choice. You've got to choose what your life is really all about. What is your most root value? What is your radical value? Not that you need to kill yourself stupidly. I've picked up a few people worried that we might just be saying be as tired as you possibly can this week. And sensible people worried about what that might mean in the future. John Wesley said, a man who kind of went around Britain trying to tell everyone the gospel, he said, the Lord has given me a gospel and a horse. And if I flog my horse to death, then I cannot tell anyone the gospel. I think that's very good advice. So actually, the goal isn't be as tired as you possibly can. The goal is do as much work and labor of the Lord as you can over a 50, 60-year period that you've got left. So I think what we're saying is don't hold back for yourself a level of kind of popularity, happiness, not tiredness that you most want. And it is very easy to self-deceive on that, isn't it? For 15 years, I've been in my head telling myself I only go kayaking to tell people the gospel. But it took me quite a long time and the pushing of a good Christian friend before we actually did a dialogue supper like the ones we were talking about the other night. And when we did, I don't know what I was so scared of. A guy who'd been going to church with his wife secretly, who said, oh, by the way, does your church do anything like Christianity Alpha or Christianity Explored? Can I come? Yeah, you can. Don't know what I've been so scared of. But we do need to choose. And the life, you know, the golf life, 50 years' time, you'll be playing a lot more golf, or the sea kayaking life, that is a wasted life, according to 1 Corinthians 15. That's Paul being a bit more aggressive. That life, the life Richard Dawkins says you must have, mustn't waste, it's so precious. And the Bible says, come on, how good is that really? Or is that actually a wasted life? Some of you know Jeff Hare. Jeff Hare did Christianity Explored 10 or so years ago. He was about 34 or so then, mid-30s. And he was kind of a master of the universe in city terms. Goldman Sachs, holidays in Thailand, all the stuff. And as I'm telling him the gospel, I'm thinking, you know, this might mess up your life. This is going to make a big difference. And he was converted. And I swallowed hard and kind of said the thing I knew that helped people. Do you want to come on camp? So again, we had that slot, didn't we, about come on camp, clean the loos, come and shovel food. And Jeff Hare came on camp, age 34, master of the universe from the city. You know, instead of being on a beach in Thailand, there he was cleaning the loos, and all the other helpers called him granddad because he was over a decade older than them. Why is he doing that? Is that a foolish waste of his life? Or is it actually the first worthwhile thing he'd ever done? As he cleans loos so that kids I know hear the gospel and end up indestructible. Which is it? And actually, in the Lord's kindness, end of the week, do you know what Jeff said? He said, that is the best holiday I've ever had because that is the only time I've ever been able to forget work. Big choices. I think it was the First World War, one of the blackmail campaigns was big poster saying, what did you do in the war, Daddy? Do you remember that? And study propaganda, First World War propaganda, kind of being, what are you going to say you did between 1914 and 1918? Turns out the smart thing to do was not be in mud, having your head blown off by a machine gun, but there you go, who knew that? What are you going to do with your life? And again, men who care a lot about their bodies, I think this is the better test, isn't it? Rather than how good a gym bunny are you, the question is, What do you do when it's dangerous and frightening and scary? I'm not sure the decision is different with women. I love reading the obituaries of the World War II women, the French resistance stuff. What are you going to do when London burned with sin and death stalked around London with his stinger full of poison? What did you do? I made a sandwich, I watched a lot of TV, and I bought a house. Or I ran through the wreckage, risking my life to pull people to safety with the words of my captain Jesus, the victor over death. None of this is to tell you what you must do. None of this is to tell you exactly what this must look like. In fact, we all need to be very careful about not looking at each other and the particular sacrifices or not that we're each making. Again, do not come to my house, see the size of my TV now, and say from now on, any Christian's allowed to have that TV. Who knows if we bought the right TV? It's about you and Jesus, your decisions. And actually, quite a lot of us hide these decisions from each other. We don't talk about them, partly because we're rightly cautious to boast about them. But I remember 12 years ago, a bunch of business people in the city and saying to William, the rector, oh, it's the first time we actually believe you about suffering for the gospel. Because 12 years ago, the new Archbishop of Canterbury was someone who disbelieved in the substitutionary death of Jesus. He didn't believe that God was ever angry with sin, and he didn't believe that you could tell sexual morality from the Bible. So what William did was publicly go in the papers and say, do you know what, I don't want to be paid by that man anymore. And he refused his salary, took a risk that maybe no one would pay him. A fairly minimal risk, he'd say, with St. Helens Church family behind you. Pretty feeble, really, he said. But the business people in the city said, oh, for the first time, we actually think you mean it. Sending us into work every day to speak for Jesus and risk our careers. I remember the same thing, putting a letter in a letterbox to the Bishop of London, saying, Bishop, you've asked a false teacher to preach at my ordination. Please don't ordain me. I remember standing there with the letter going on, thinking, this is my career, going in the toilet as I put this letter in. There it goes. You may think it's a very pathetic thing to want a career in the Church of England, want to be a bishop or whatever, but I tell you, for my family, and Claire's family actually, non-Christian family, that is, what's the point if you're not going to be a bishop? All of us will make different decisions. We're all sinners. We don't want to point at each other, I'm giving out more than you are. The point is that Paul was not misrepresenting God, verse 15, when he told you about the gospel of Jesus, which means these are the words of Jesus, the victorious king of the future, through his servant Paul, which means you and I have a choice. You can live for now, the cursed creation, or you can live for then, the perfect creation. You can live for self, or you can live for him. Let me pray for us as we go from here to make our choices. Father God, praise you for your grace to Paul, but then to any Christian, to give us labor that is not in vain. The kind of labor Adam had before he sinned, the kind of labor we'll have in the new creation, the kind of labor even here as sinful people with mixed motives and messed up hearts, that we can labor for you for the victory over death and know that that is not in vain. Father, please help us get this through our heads and into our lives. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.